Thank you so much, Paul, for inviting me here. I'm delighted to be here. It's great to meet some new people and to meet some people whose work I have read or I've heard about. Thank you also to the Arts Council of Northern Ireland, who gave me some funding so that I could get my book published, and also to Durrow Press, who published the book. I was brought up, I was in the north of the north, way up on the north coast, and I've travelled and lived in different countries, but where we lived was very, very rural, and so when we were small, we didn't really go in the car that much because we just had a very, very small world. And anywhere I lived, I always sort of carried this internal map with me. There's a poet from the north, John Hewitt, who I'm sure you know. He isn't actually that well known himself, but he was a huge influence on poets like Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley, Maeve McGugian, and he wrote a very long poem celebrating the names of townlands. So that's why this poem is after John Hewitt, and it's the first poem in the book. Early Map. I know my way by the mossy stone, the boggy field, the fairy thorn, the house with the old milk churn stand, the house which hides the bogeyman, the cross where the Bray meets Kilmoy, the lazy bends, the arch, the school. Names I was raised with slipped down like buttermilk and fresh baked wheaten. The mountain behind, the Antrim Plateau, make their own picture, our window, the frame. Townlands stretch to the east and the west, the north and the south of us, shining basalt in my mind, falling water through my hands, ripe blackberries on my tongue, Drumtulla, Dunseverick, Lisnagunyo. The next poem was a poem that you mentioned earlier, it was made into a film, just really again set in North Antrim where I was brought up. When I had my own children and I put them in the back of my bike, it kind of reminded me of my own childhood. It's called Push Bike. She wrapped a tea towel around buns or a brack, packed sandwiches into a bread bag, and strapped me into the seat on the back. I pressed against her, arms around her waist, her strong swimmer's legs pushing us up the Bray. Legs that had saved a child from a whirlpool that day in Donegal. Long grasses, cow parsley, crowded us as she worked and swayed and sang. Then up we go, Owen Tony up with his ice cream cart. On evenings in summer, we called with neighbours, Annie's sick brother, James's mother. One August evening, daylight almost gone, she clicked the dynamo on. I heard its secret song. Up we go. Up we go, Antonio. The lamp flickered in time with the pedals when she stood up in the saddle for the hill. Down the other side, it was all free wheel, hedges, midges, swallows flitted past, till we spun faster, faster. Her blowing hair and laughter were all a blur as the warm air and wheels whir lulled me to sleep against her constant back. The next one I'd like to read again is set on the north coast. Although we lived inland, we were actually not far from the sea, and there was a wonderful natural rock pool which is about the same size as a swimming pool. And this is kind of a summer poem, actually. I don't know why I should read it in the winter, but anyway. And we all learnt to swim, and the name of the place and the name of the poem is Don Severin. On hot days, she packed a picnic after school, crammed us all into the clapped-out console, and drove to the coast where big, flat rocks held the day's heat. We changed into swim togs, spread out the rug, lashed on amber solaire, then dared each other, the first swim of the year. We splashed and charged and roared into the water, came out mottled, numb. She squeezed dry our hair, wrapped us in towels, shoved on wind cheaters, gave us hunks of wheaten slapped together with a wedge of Edmund Black's good cheddar, gone sweaty in the sun. We crowded round her, drank lukewarm orange from a plastic cup, shared out a melting bar of fruit and nut, or fruit and nut, as my mum would have said. She was actually from Dublin, even though I was brought up in the north. I don't know this one by heart, but I'd like to read it because I was having a good conversation with Tom earlier about libraries, and I'm a big fan of libraries. I'd like to read this. The library van. There was a carpet in the mobile library that called to ours every other Tuesday about 4 o'clock. We ran to the gate, clanged up metal treads into the lull and smell of books stacked on shelves from floor to ceiling with names and words we longed to know. The north wind rocked the van as we sat cross-legged, floated out over the Sperrins to forests in Germany, rabbit holes in England, darkest Peru, and later to a heath in Yorkshire, the deep south, the veldt. I did anything for a book. Read them on the back doorstep while the kitchen floor was mopped. Took them down fields on sunny days, curled like a comma on the bed on rainy holidays in Donegal. The date stamp and the cardboard ticket were my passport out. As I scanned for signs from those who had been before, turned down a page, left a crumb, a pressed carnation. So there was a total eclipse of the moon recently, so I think I'd like to read this. My father explains the universe. The sun does not actually set. The moon does not actually rise. One evening at the kitchen table, my father plucked a grapefruit from the bowl. That is the sun, he said, and that, holding up a Jaffa orange, is the earth. He held the grapefruit still, worked the orange round and round, showed us day and night, winter and summer. But why do we not fall off, we asked, and what about the moon? He handed me an apple. I held the moon, saw it wax and wane, a total eclipse, the pool of the tides. Then we put on our coats over our pyjamas to see the plough, the seven sisters, Orion's belt. I never understood how their lights had gone out, yet we could see them. Think of it like this, he said. When someone you love is dead, they are gone, but their light shines for years to come. And then my mother did actually die when I was quite young. I've written a few sonnets with her in the background, including the Don Severin one and this one, which actually started off as a really, really long poem with about 60 lines in it, and then it got whittled down to 14. And I was reading somewhere recently, Paul Muldoon was saying, I'm sure he's not actually the first person to have said it, but how, you know, a sonnet is more or less like the same length as a thought process. But I'm sure it's the same in this part of the world. But one of the things that I find and still find really comforting about when there's bereavement is all the rituals, the sort of everyday rituals that accompany bereavement. Not religious rituals, just things that people do, especially in the country, but I mean in the north they do it in the city as well. So this is called offering. For months after the funeral, they came from all over. And if we were not about, each left a simple offering at the house. A bag of spuds set on the porch, no name. A pheasant plucked from the road up the back. A couple of mackerel, poaching, whiskey, Madonna and child in a holy picture. On the windowsill, a tin with a big farm brack, a whole cheese from away down the glen, a pot of stew still warm on the doorstep. Between these gifts, there was no difference. Left foot or right, we were all one in this, scarring our minds for a sign in the face of death. We hurled our prayers into the same sky, same earth. I'm sure you probably know this, but in the north, you know, that expression about left foot or right has to do with which religion you are. I don't know if that expression is here or not. I think I better read something funny now. Well, lighter, I should say. I'm not sure this is actually funny, but if you're a poet, you know what a sestina is. And I think everybody's here is a poet or a writer of some sort. But anyway, if you don't know what it is, you don't want to know what it is, really. But if for anybody who doesn't know, it's basically you take six words and you repeat them in different order throughout the poem, and then you bring them all together at the end. But I really had a bit of fun with six words. I think I had words like coffee and nut and different things that I played on. But you know, there was a time in Belfast when there were not lots of coffee shops and connoisseur coffee shops. So I sort of wrote this. They've really only come in the last 10 years or so. Before that, you couldn't really get a proper cup of coffee in Belfast, but now they're everywhere. So this is called Cafe. "You're effing nuts," he said to me that day in the cafe as we sat holding hands. Not after that. I still stayed on, latte with hazelnut syrup, my stomach in knots, as he laid into me, said I was underhand right there in the cafe. As I sipped my cafe con leche, he said that he was washing his hands, that I was just effing nuts, and it was to do with me, and he was not to blame, absolutely not. I should wake up and smell the coffee. Always me, me, me. And that was that in a nutshell. I might as well raise my hands now, but he would hand it to me. At least I was not as much of a fruit and nut case as that other caffeine head, and that was something, even for me. Then here's me. I grabbed his hand. I said that I did not want him to pay for my coffee, even though it cost peanuts. Not that I was. I could handle that particular cappuccino. I did not stay and took my cafe noisette with me. In Belfast, where I moved away from a few years ago, but I lived there for a while, quite a long time. there was a bar called the Rotterdam Bar, which a few years ago was knocked down. But it was in the docks area, and the docks area in Belfast now has all been refurbished and gentrified and made expensive, and there's a big Titanic quarter and everything. But there was this bar anyway, and it was in the docks area. And if you hadn't booked a taxi before the end of the night, it was really hard to get away from the bar because it was far away from the city centre and everywhere else. So this is set when there were still it was still during the Troubles, but sometimes there were some lighter moments. Cycling home from the Rotterdam Bar. It was a faff to get back from the Rotterdam. I had my bike, so was heading on home. While the others stood waiting for a taxi, you hopped on behind me and took a backy on my bag rack, legs splayed out while I steered. Three sheets to the wind, we sailed through the back streets. With a couple of pints in us, we were in slow-mo, like under the strobe light at the disco. So the checkpoint in May Street, no worries. Even as you swayed behind me in the carrier, full of Dutch courage, we were invincible. They waved us on through, like a bike was invisible. Then called to our backs just as we disappeared. Hey, that's dangerous. You've got no lights on your rear. When over your shoulder, you fired back the quip. Aye, sure's okay, for look, my arse light's up. So I ran the old museum arts centre venue in Belfast, and at that time it was kind of a precursor to a much bigger arts centre now, the MAC, but this was a very small venue. And at that time there, we did try to bring lots of visiting poets to Belfast. Jane Cortez was a wonderful jazz blues poet from the States. And she was kind of a contemporary of Alice Walker, Maya Angelou, June Jordan, more or less within 5 to 10 years, same rough era as them. So her thing was jazz blues poetry. In fact, she was, her son is Donardo Coleman. She was married to Ornette Coleman. And sadly, Jane died a few years ago. But she had a band called the Fire Spitters who played jazz when she was reciting her wonderful poetry. And so we got her to Belfast, to the old museum, which was the Arts Centre. Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters at the old museum. Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters played the old museum. Afterwards, not many places open then. We went for a meal, but where? I don't remember. Next morning, I drove her to catch her plane. Her flight was first thing. Took the scenic route over the mountain, murals, views over the city. We passed the bottom of the white rock, up the Glen Road, then a roadblock, a white cordon. We would have to double back. A joyrider shot dead early that morning. We hadn't listened to the radio. Diversion. Just go the motorway. That night, a clip on the 6 o'clock news showed my golden Vauxhall Astra at the scene, slowing up at the checkpoint, open windows. A 3-point turn, a query, a frown. Jane beside me chanting, unsubmissive blues. Unsubmissive blues, yeah, unsubmissive blues, unsubmissive blues. Unsubmissive blues is the title of one of Jane Cortez's albums. It's not my line. I'd like to dedicate this, well, this poem is dedicated to my friend Anne-Marie. She is a survivor of the Troubles. She's in her 50s now. But she was injured when she was a child. And without going on too much about the Troubles, but you know, there is still a lot of fallout for a lot of people all these years later. She only just got her driving test recently because of her injuries. She has made a fantastic recovery, and I was working on a project with her a few years ago when I met her, and she has a fantastic sense of humour. The thing about plastic bullets, which you probably know, is that they always seem to me a misnomer. They sound as if they're like a little milk bottle top or something, but they're actually really, really heavy. Large pieces of solid PVC, so they've done a lot of damage. Plastic bullet. As if it is a children's toy for sale in the local pound shop, for say, age 3+, contains small parts, may cause choking, not suitable for infants, British kite mark, to find tossed, forgotten under the kitchen table, or in a tidy box to hide the mess. That Tuesday was just normal. Anne-Marie went a message, a packet of Mary biscuits for her man, a pint of milk, and don't forget, 10 silk cut. Keep the change, a penny chew for being good when it started. She can still feel it, blindsided, hunkered in the doorway. 3 years just to learn the words ball, mummy, bye-bye, again. Or the one she speaks to me now, turning her whole head to see me with her one good eye, as we cross the car park in the rain this Tuesday at the back end of January. 3 years just to put one foot in front of the other again. Sharp as the wind that would skin you, she tells me her story. She was just 15. A 3-inch steel plate where part of her skull used to be. But she just goes on, nothing else for it. When I slosh into a puddle in the rain, damp and grit seep in around my foot. Oh no, I've a hole in my boot, I complain. Sure, I have a big hole in my head, she tuts. You don't hear me, gurn. One of the things that I loved when I was a student was getting away, getting to Europe. Ironically, it feels safer in Belfast now than it does in Paris or London, which is quite nerve-wracking. But this is set during peace talks. But I can't remember which peace talks there were, because there were so many peace talks and talks about talks. But there's always something going on. Chartres Cathedral is a place that I always wanted to visit. So this is called Getting to Chartres During Peace Talks Back Home. We arranged to meet in Chartres. A week Tuesday, the cathedral, outside on a seat, if there was one. If we miss you, then go on. We'll see you in the south or wherever. We hitched out of Paris on the E50, pitched our tent beside a motorway. Awoke next morning surrounded by cows. Boy, Chartres was hard to get to, off the main auto route. We arrived around lunch, and there you were on the bench, reading a book, expecting us, our clothes all covered in dust. You poured half a bottle of Evian over my dirty, blistered feet. We ate peaches, cheese, baguettes, then entered the cool of the Alps, the August sun through the stained glass, gold, amber, violet. The rose windows mosaic made a walk through kaleidoscope into years of emerald, sapphire, projected onto the floor. Your platinum blonde hair, a halo. Maybe it was being suddenly still in one place again after all that travel. That and the thirst, the heat, the light. There was a moment, like Stendhal's, when everything stopped. A film with no sound. We were underwater or high above clouds, all our history washed clean, as if walking into the mountain. Onto the top of our heads, a rain of amethyst light, of blessings poured in. Through the open door, I heard a pigeon, a rock dove, call into the middle of the silence. Same note here as its Irish equivalent, remembered the name Colombe in French. And as I'm sure you remember from your school day French, Colombe is dove in French. I'm just going to do one more poem now. It's a short poem. And I just wanted to say about that poem about Stendhal, the Stendhal moment. I'm sure a lot of you know, but Stendhal wrote about a character who had this sense of great bliss when he was in a cathedral. And there is actually a syndrome called the Stendhal syndrome, which is a feeling of great bliss or faintness when you're exposed to great art or architecture, which I think is fantastic, the idea that there's a name given to something that's a feeling of bliss caused by art. Pardon? Stendhal moment. So this is just a short poem. I would like to thank Avail again. I'd like to thank Paul. Thank you so much. This is a wonderful, wonderful event, and it seems to be a fantastic series. And I just hope that you keep able to do it, and that you get the proper funding. There's a field at the top of the road where I live now, and on the 1st of February, on Bridget's Day, I always go there with my daughter, and we gather rushes and make Bridget's crosses. And lots of other Irish female poets have written poems about Bridget's Day better than I. However, I just wanted to say that, obviously, as you know, Bridget was the goddess of fertility and light, and the harvest, but also poetry. This is called Rushes on Port Macaya on St. Bridget's Day. I grow in the meadow field where land gives way to the Atlantic. Salt wind and boggy ground make me who I am. Northampton, basalt, holds me beyond reason. When I find myself in your house, I know my day has come. I have been waiting for your hands. Your fingers work me. I fold open into the shape I was always meant to be. Three times fire goddess, first catkin, a word, a sign. Thank you very much for listening.